Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. The subject of this installment of Periodical Radio is Psychological Reports, a bi-monthly scholarly journal in its 54th year of publication. Psychological Reports is an oft-cited and highly regarded journal. The editor's stated purpose is to encourage scientific originality and creativity in the field of general psychology. Examples of such originality and creativity in a recent issue include articles on whether evolutionary sex differences impact Nintendo Wii performance, eye color as an indicator of behavior, and the relationship of insubordination with genius. Each issue has about 40 articles, filling approximately 300 pages, and there's no advertising. My guest is Dr. Doug Ammons, one of the editors of Psychological Reports. Dr. Ammons, let's go ahead and let's start the origins of Psychological Reports and your involvement with it. Let's begin with the contrast and the comparison of Psychological Reports and Perceptual and Motor Skills to American Psychological Association journals. They're big leaders in the field of psychology, and yet the Ammons Scientific journals have done very well over the years. Been very successful. What do you see as the primary distinguishing differences of your journal from your journals from those of the American Psychological Association?
Well, first I'd say that the APA does a very good job. They represent the largest psychology organization in the world, and they've got their plate full of a lot of different things and 150-some thousand odd members. You know, very diverse membership. So when they publish the way they see it as a large organization, and the contrast really is that we are not a large organization. We're a very small group of individuals, and from the very outset, the reason for having the journals was to provide an alternative to the mainstream APA journals. And the fact of the matter is there's a lot going on in psychology and in every area that's outside of any major organization. That organization involves the people who are interested in being in an organization. And so it doesn't include an awful lot of other people who have perfectly legitimate and interesting views in the world, in psychology in particular here. And otherwise, they don't have a place to go to be heard, to have their work peer-reviewed carefully, and to have an outlet for it. So that's what we provide.
You're very consciously an alternative to the APA journals. You want there to be an independent outlet.
Yes, yeah. And we have any organization, and I'm not going to accuse them of any particular bias, but any organization, any group of people, especially one with a real clear hierarchy, develops, you know, its own political beliefs and, you know, within the hierarchy. And there's just no way of getting around that. And I think it's a process that develops quite naturally out of the fact that you have a big group of people who are all trying to do something in general, and they all have their own beliefs. So in contrast, then, we don't have this organization. We are not a spokesman for any group. And therefore, all we try to do is look at science in the broadest sense and take on anybody who's willing to present a well-done article of any kind, be it experimental or theoretical or a commentary or other, take them on and evaluate it. Without any axes to grind, without any external biases, but purely from a scientific method. And I think that what that does is you get a lot. There are a lot of people out there. There are a lot of foreign authors. There are a lot of people who are outside the specific consensus mainstream, which is what the APA really generally publishes. And really, by definition, everything in science that we believe now at one point or another came on as a reaction to the ongoing consensus of that time and disagreed with it or contradicted it. So I think in general, nobody's got a crystal ball for where the field's going to go or where the world's going to go, what fate will have in store with us. And the only thing that we can do is leave the playing field open for as many different well-reasoned positions as possible. That's the only way that science will progress.
In the pages of the journal, one of the things that comes out as a contrast is as that process is happening, the APA journals tend to publish articles that are from 20 to 40 pages long, and those in Psychological Reports tend to be quite a bit shorter, 4 or 5 dozen pages, sometimes longer, but on average, much shorter. What's the reasoning behind that?
It's actually the average number of pages in an article for us is about 10 pages now. And it might be a little bit longer in the APA, but it depends on the journal. It depends on the field, too. You know, so I think if one looked at a given journal and made a comparison, then you'd be comparing something a little more similar. The thing is, I'd say in general, though, we try to cut to the quick,
mm-hmm.
and attempt to have people say what they have to say as succinctly and clearly as possible. I guess one of the things that I commonly put on an article when I'm editing it, or a manuscript when I'm editing it, is I, in one form or another, I say, you know, write as succinctly and precisely as possible exactly what you mean. And I think that there's just a little more leeway in other journals for, you know, taking a little bit extra.
Sure.
Academics are notorious for liking lots of words.
Indeed. The front matter of Psychological Reports states that articles are reviewed from 3 to up to 20 peer reviewers. How do you decide how many reviewers an article needs?
Well, I'm the one that assigns reviewers. And in each case, with each article, unless it's like a one-page note comment, any manuscript that comes in, I'm going to look at, and I'm going to make an initial assessment. Does it fit? Is the writing adequate enough to be sent out? And if it's not, I'm going to send it back to them saying, and I might give some editorial suggestions, but also that they really need to shore it up and give a short list of what they need to focus on. With the reviewers, I will always assign 6 reviewers, and we'll go through the first 3 and send those out, and then if we don't get response we'll do the first 4, and if we don't get the response from at least 2, if not 3, then we'll go through the next 3 to 6. And then if we still don't have enough, then I will add some more. And then that upper limit then changes depending on the hot button issue. If it's an issue that obviously has political problems, that's going to stir up some major controversy or even minor controversy, I'm going to extend the reviewers to as wide a variety as I can within reason. And so the upper number of 20 there, it's actually 21 is the largest number. We've done that a number of times. It's just for papers that clearly hit people right square on their hot buttons, and so we just want to have the best set of comments that we possibly can.
How do you recruit your peer reviewers?
Well, I mean, we start with our associate editors, and then we have another. You know, we have a database of probably 15,000 reviewers, people who we've contacted and have done one or more reviews for us. And that's constantly expanding. So I'll start with those 2 things, and if we don't have something, you know, it'll also come from the reference page of the manuscript itself. And if that's still a problem, I will scurry around and attempt to identify some other likely people.
Do your authors ever recommend a reviewer? Do they send a note with? What do you think of that? I mean, do you like that information?
Fine. That's fine, yeah. And typically we would include at least one of those people, because we're going to include 3 or 4 others who, you know, are going to be different. And the authors, I think, are usually pretty good, in my experience, about suggesting people who are perfectly legitimate and fair. I had one notable manuscript about 3 weeks ago where, when once I started looking, it turned out that this author had really tread on the toes of the two biggest guys in this particular little subfield. Enough so that one of the very first abstracts I pulled up in looking at the topic, these original authors who he was criticizing, actually just had an alternative view. Anyway, he had tweaked them so much that they had actually devoted a major portion of their abstract to debunking him from their standpoint. And I thought that was a little over the top. I'm negatively suggestible by nature. If somebody says, this is the truth, I'm going to say, well, yeah, let me see. What about B, C, D, E, F, G, H, all the way through J, mm-hmm. and C, and as Dr. Seuss says, on beyond zebra. Just because, you know, somebody thinks something is the case doesn't mean it is the case, no matter who they are. And so with that, I take that attitude with all the reviewing. So if authors suggest something, I'll certainly consider it, oftentimes use at least one, and then I'll look for others. Because there's many, many different reasons why people will take up one position or another, or want to review or not want to review. Some people want to review and they don't have time for it. So there are many different reasons. But we all try to get, for all manuscripts, a minimum number, which is at least one more. I mean, it's a total of at least three, which is, you know, typically a journal will have one or two. And we always get more than that. Every single paper in our that we publish has been through more peer review than almost any other article. But I should say with that the nature of our peer review is somewhat different, and that has to do directly with our editorial attitudes. And I'll say it this way: the easiest thing for an editor to do in the world is to say, "I reject this." And then the easiest thing for the editor to do is to rationalize that he's rejecting it because he has such incredibly high standards. Actually, he's just being lazy. Because the hardest thing to do is to actually engage what the author has to say and engage what the reviewers have to say and try to find whatever resolution there might be to further science. So the issue is whether your commitment is to further science by helping people do research and to help people argue their position or argue alternative positions, or whether your point of view is just to make life easy for yourself because you're so overworked.
And before our interview, you worded that to me as scientific freedom of speech.
Well, that's what I would say. I mean, I have a couple of ways that, to me, express in a nutshell where we're coming from. And the first of those is our journals are the scientific expression of freedom of speech. They're intended to reflect the entire field of psychology worldwide, and that means that they'll always reflect highly diverse approaches and topics, positions, and any other aspect that some people will disagree with and other people will agree with. And so the issue is that understanding the nature of human and animal behavior isn't just an undertaking of American or European scientists. It's not just an undertaking of the APA. It includes all nationalities and all the unpredictable diversity thereof. So the other aspect, in a nutshell, is the scientific method will always be our touchstone, coupled with freedom of interpretation and position. Science is the greatest problem-solving tool humans have ever devised, even if it isn't all that easily applicable to something as complicated as human behavior. And as another principle, I'd say that no reviewer has a veto right based solely on their opinion or their personal interpretation. So if their objections are based on fact, they can demonstrate a flaw in the analysis or method, or if they can point out a logical fallacy, then their objections are really likely to be sustained by me as an editor. But I will say one thing. That's providing the authors can't justify what they've done, because what they've done might just be a limitation of the current methods. And so that is a very difficult place sometimes to balance. So those are key issues about where we're coming from and what we're trying to do. I would say maybe the last one is that I'm never going to just lop off an author, you know, and reject it without him having a fair hearing. I want everybody to go away, all the authors and the reviewers. My goal is, as an editor, all the authors and all the reviewers go away from the experience thinking, you know, that's the way the scientific method should work. That's the way that publication should be done.
And that reputation is known and no doubt of primary, if not the primary, reason why Psychological Reports has such a good reputation. Would you agree?
Well, I would hope so.
Let's switch gears a little bit now.
I'll say one thing.
Sure.
I don't have any control over what people feel is a reputation. All I can do is do the very best I can according to those principles.
And sure.
The difficulty sometimes comes in where people, they conflate, they mix up their personal belief with what they think is true. And when you do that, then basically you're saying that something is not true because you disagree with it. And that's a very prominent thing. It happens with everybody, all of us, and it happens with psychologists as well in their science. And so one thing I won't do is when a reviewer says, well, no reputable journal would ever blah, 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 I just think, you know, the problem here is that you are trying to strong-arm me
mm-hmm.
and the author and everybody else by declaring what is reputable and what isn't. That is, they're declaring what's truth and what isn't. And they don't know. No, none of us know. And that's why we're doing science. It's our best approximation for trying to figure out a little bit about what is true. And I find it a totally inspiring process. But when people mistake their personal emotionality for something, they mistake that for scientific truth, well then, you know, we're just dealing with psychological pathology instead of peer review. So I try to keep that stuff out, and I make a very concerted effort, as do the other editors here, for identifying it while respecting each person's point of view. And I hope that message gets through to authors, reviewers, and readers.
Very good. I'd like to change focus a little bit now to more of a little bit of the business end of running the journal. People unfamiliar with scholarly publishing are sometimes surprised that not only are your authors not paid, but they actually pay to have their articles published. Will you explain for us how author fees work and why they make sense for Psychological Reports?
Well, I'd say as a general framework, page fees are very common in a great number of areas of science. For instance, geophysics, wildlife biology, cryobiology, paleontology, and a whole bunch of others. If you go in, you will find page charges anywhere from, for instance, in cryobiology, about $25 a page, which is about ours, up to $400, $500, $600, $800 a page for certain other journals. And there's a sliding tier. So in psychology, though, we are one of the few journals that has a page charge. And so we do stand out that way, and that is sometimes something people try to use as a club against us, saying that, well, we're just paying. Authors are just paying. The issue is that the page charges are just one aspect of a whole variety of ways of paying the costs that it takes to get a journal published. And always, in all journals, those costs have to be paid, or else the journal can't publish. So it takes the place, for instance, like Science and Nature, which are excellent journals, half of their pages are advertisements. High, you know, biochemical companies, biological assay companies, immunology companies, and so on, are paying top dollar for a big ad. And we don't have any advertising. The APA designates by budget how much a journal's budget will be for their journal. Okay, that automatically lops off the size of the journal purely by a central planning. We don't have that. The page charges allow us more freedom in how many pages that we can publish. And I think it's that the author or his institution can help support the work, because it's as a combined effort, it's really a service for the field, for improving the field. Nobody's getting rich off this, except maybe some of the huge for-profit publishers who are charging, you know, increases in subscription prices 15-20% a year. We don't do that. We keep it right down to a bare minimum, and the page charges are really a part of that. So so there's all these different mechanisms by which one can cover the costs. People, even the editors, like, for instance, I would say, in my experience, none of the editors of the APA journals have any clue about what their journal actually costs to print. Mm-hmm. The estimates are from their central, from their main committee, $8,000 an article, and so that price has to be paid by somebody, by some way. It could be paid by dues for the organization, but we don't have an organization. When you have dues in an organization, it's like having a union. You know, then everybody has a say, and then they have union bosses, and you have politics. We try to stay out of that. So the page charges are part of the thing that help keep us independent. And again, they're completely common across other areas in science, and they can range, and they're usually much, much higher than ours.
Right.
One last example, which is the every journal that the American Statistical Association publishes has page charges of $55 to $75 a page, and you know, and the statisticians don't blink an eye at that. They don't think any. I mean, it's just part of the mechanism for how they're able to have a journal that can publish their work.
Mm-hmm.
So a magazine is in a different stretch of things. It's a for-profit venture.
Right.
Okay, and so. I actually write magazine articles in kayaking because I'm a longtime expedition kayaker and I've done a lot of stuff in that area. So, you know, sometimes I do stuff for free because I believe in the project. But nobody can put food on the table if they're doing things for free all the time. So, you know, the magazine functions in a very different way.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
You currently allow authors to post online the last pre-publication version of their articles, even though copyright is owned by Ammons Scientific of the final version. Is that policy working?
Well, it depends on what you mean by working. I'd say yes. But, of course, authors would like to just put their article up. But the problem is, when they do that, the copyright basically becomes meaningless, and anybody can copy anything. And that's one of the problems with open access in general. You know, an author's last pre-publication version is their last work that they. I mean, it still includes our efforts as editors and the reviewers, but it's still their last work that has not actually gone through to completion into journal form. So it's the last best thing, and it's a struggle. You know, one would like to have all information available to everybody who wants it. And the problem, again, comes back to there's no way to prop up such a system like that because these things don't just come of their own without immense work by a lot of different people. So unless that immense work is compensated in some way, people just simply can't afford to do it.
So would it be your take that most of the advocates or many of the advocates of open access underestimate and undervalue the work that editors and publishers do?
Well, I think, I'm not sure if you use the word undervalue. I think that there's a difference of opinion. I think the more activist open access, let me back up. First, I think open access is a great idea, personally. And we actually have an open access policy that we've started here. And the problem comes in how do the costs get paid? And the most adamant and aggressive of the open access advocates are responding to what I consider to be horrific increases by the main for-profit publishers, just horrifically huge increases that are completely unjustified by the market and by what the journals actually cost. I mean, 20-25% a year. It's unbelievable, and year after year. And the libraries pay those things. The students pay it through their fees. The taxpayers support it for, you know, having a public university, for instance, that, you know, has a library budget. that's where all that money was being skimmed from. And so that's where the aggravated open access advocates are coming from. They don't like that, and I don't like it either. But the problem is that they, in return, when they advocate complete open access, they are completely looking at the system in an unrealistic way, because it does require expertise, it does require time, it does require lots of materials, machinery, and special knowledge and equipment in order to put a journal out. And I think you use the word undervalue. I think they undervalue that.
Doctor.
So somewhere in between the rapacious for-profit publishers who are charging exorbitant fees and increases each year, someplace between that extreme and the open access aggros, mm-hmm. someplace in there is a reasonable compromise, and that's what we have been trying to find. So, and I think we are very close to it. So the open access, if you get away from that open access extreme, what you find out with the Public Library of Science journals is that they still are not a viable business model, even though they're charging $3,000 up front for each article that they publish. They're still not making ends meet, and it's even worse than that, because they are propped up by very large funds that have been donated to them. And it's a reasonable startup. It's a good attempt, but what they're finding out is that it takes much more energy and much more money than they thought to make it work. So I'm hopeful in the long run that it will work in one way, but the only way it will work is that if people actually realistically apprise and solve the problem of cost.
Dr. Ammons, our time is coming to the end, but I want to ask one quick question to finish up. Do you think psychological reports will still be published in print in 10 years?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
I think it's an issue. It depends on whether libraries still want print copies. We will always print some, because if the power goes out and everything is online, you have nothing. You might as well be in the Stone Age.
Indeed.
So there is something to be said for Gutenberg, the movable type.
Well, Dr. Ammons, our time is up. Thank you very, very much for your time. It's been a fascinating interview.
Yep, you're very welcome. Thank you for calling.
A subscription to Psychological Reports costs $440. Subscription details are online at www.ammonscientific.com. Thank you for listening to Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.